I got some great questions in here tonight, and I really appreciated the chance to deal with those issues. There's some things, more things I'm going to learn. We're going to have a lot more programs out here, and I just am grateful to the hospitality I've been given in the state of New Hampshire. I'm going to be up here a lot.
General, on May 11, 2001, you gave a speech in Little Rock. It was the day after the first Bush tax cut was voted in.
Right.
You praised that tax cut. Not only that, you were exuberant about how great George Bush and his whole administration was. What's changed?
Everything's changed since then. This administration has taken us into a reckless war. It's got an economic policy that is nothing but tax cuts. He promised us that the tax cuts would make us wealthy. He promised the tax cuts would bring jobs. They've made us poor. They haven't brought jobs. This is an administration that's lost the confidence of the American people and certainly lost my confidence. I did not vote for this administration anyway. I'll tell you that right now. I mean, I've made it very clear. I voted for Vice President Gore to be the President of the United States. But that having been said, this was a new administration. I know a lot of people in this administration. I've been terribly, terribly disappointed with this administration.
General, you've made very good use of the web and the internet in the draft movement. I wonder how you plan to use the web, blogging, otherwise, in your campaign.
Well, I can't get into all the technicalities about it because I've been on the road now for, I think, 7 days from Little Rock. There's been a whole transformation and an improvement in the web process down in Little Rock. We got some of the smartest people in the world down there. I can assure you we're going to knock their socks off with the web. I'm really excited about it, and I can hardly wait to get back to Little Rock on Sunday and see it.
Do you read your blog? Will you write on your blog?
Of course. I will see it, and I will write on it. But how much of that? It'll be a function of all the other pressing demands of the campaign. I think clearly the first thing I've got to do at this point is I've got to really work the policy process. People are asking a lot of questions. I've got some answers, but I need a lot more answers a lot more quickly. And I think one of the first things we're going to have to do is really look at the economic outlook for the United States. The tax cuts that President Bush put us in have put us in a hole. They've been a failure of economic policy, not an economic policy. We can't meet our pressing needs if those tax cuts and that fiscal policy is not relooked.
You talked about moral responsibility in Kosovo. What moral responsibility would you try to have towards Africa, especially with the AIDS pandemic, and would you have gone in Liberia, and what would you have done to help the people there?
Well, I think the best principle you can go with is one that President Clinton expressed. He said, when you can make a difference, you should. Our resources are not unlimited. We cannot do everything in the world. And you can see that now when you look at the case in Iraq. The president's asking for $87 billion. That $87 billion is coming from somewhere. It's coming from our schools. It's coming from our power plants, our improvement of the electricity grid in this country to fix up their electricity grid and so forth. That's why some friends of mine in Congress have introduced legislation that says for every school that's built in Iraq, you've got to build one in the United States. It makes a lot of sense. So you can't do everything. So you have to pick what you do. And that's why you have to work with allies, because our allies, like the French, can take actions in Africa, and they can take responsibilities in African places, so we don't have to do that. In general, we've been trying to do that. But AIDS is a special case. AIDS is a national security problem. It's destroying countries and societies in Africa. We have to put resources into AIDS education and AIDS treatment. It's right to do it, but it's also in America's self-interest to do it, because that kind of human misery is a destructive force unleashed in Africa. We want to prevent it, and we have the power to fix it, and we should be working AIDS in a very serious fashion in this economy. Now, with respect to Liberia, we've been in Liberia before. We still have responsibility for Liberia. They were our people that went over there and founded the country. Charles Taylor had a lot of connections here on the East Coast. We're in and out of Liberia all the time. I don't know what the hesitation was. We could have stopped the fighting in Liberia when we first started talking about intervening. Instead, we stayed on the sidelines. We dillied, we dallied, We sent survey teams in. We chewed out the survey team commander because he gave a report that was more detailed and more prescriptive than the Pentagon wanted to hear. I guess they only wanted to hear, you know, what the dimensions of the airfield were, not whether he thought we should actually take action to save people's lives. But I would have done Liberia, and I'd have done it sooner and with a larger force.
How impressed have you been at the job our nation's intelligence agencies have been doing for us in the past few years?
Well, some things the intelligence agencies do very, very well. We're really good on the technical side. We have unmatched capabilities to see, to listen, to sniff, to do a lot of other things. But the areas where we're not very good is, in the past, we haven't wanted to risk American personnel lives. So we've generally relied on foreign intelligence sources for the detailed close-in work with the trench coats and so forth. And that leaves you open. You don't know that you're being given the right information. You can't check it. You don't know about the reliability of the people. There's a lot of double agents in that field. People are scared. You're doing the best you can, but it's not highly reliable. So you take the case of Iraq. I'd seen the intelligence for years, and the intelligence on the Iraqi weapons of mass destruction program started with the assumption that since he had them, he wanted to keep them. And since he was trying to frustrate the UN inspectors, he must have something to hide. So there's your two sort of starting assumptions. And then you knew that he had intelligent people. You knew that there were connections with Iraqi front organizations that would try to purchase things. You weren't always sure what they were purchased for, but you got the idea that he was evading sanctions. And so you put one plus one plus one together. You say, hey, look, he didn't cooperate. He's probably got some of this stuff. But I'm not sure that we ever knew where it was or that we ever knew how much there was. And if you look closely at Secretary Powell's briefing in front of Congress, there were suspicious radio transmissions and vehicles around bunkers. And there were reports of materials unaccounted for. And so you can sort of add those up, and they certainly imply something. But you can never expect of your intelligence agencies that in every case they can give you legally sufficient evidence that will always justify action. And partly that's a function of the nature of the problem, and partly it's a function of the way we've responded. So I give our intelligence agencies pretty good marks, but they're not perfect. And it's up to our decision makers to understand that and not to fill in the blanks, not to extrapolate, and not always to assume the worst case, because in this case, the worst case assumption was wrong.
My name is Jonathan Phillips. I'm from Manchester, New Hampshire, although originally from England. General Clark, I'm curious about Middle East policy. Mainly the focus has been on Iraq, but there's two areas I would like to question you on. One is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and how you would approach that as president, and secondly, Iran, and if you could include the fact that if Iran does become a nuclear power. Thank you.
Well, these are big issues, and they're important issues. First, the Arab-Israeli dispute. We came relatively close in the summer of 2000 at Camp David. It came down to two key issues, the right of return and the status of Jerusalem. Those two issues need to be worked and discussed at various levels by various groups between the Israelis and the Palestinians, by Israeli Labor Party people with Palestinian colleagues, and back and forth and back and forth. Some of that discussion is going on, and some people believe there are solutions in hand. But it has to be knitted together across all parts of the societies on both sides. Then you need to establish a framework for peace in the region. And that means you've got to reach to the other countries and ask them to fulfill their responsibilities. There's really little reason to believe that we can be totally successful in bringing peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians if it's in the interests of the Saudis or the Iranians or the Syrians or the Jordanians or the Egyptians to have conflict. And so these countries have to fulfill their responsibilities. And then finally, we've got to recognize this is a rough and rocky process. The Israelis have a right to self-defense. Nobody can deny that. When they receive word that terrorists are coming in to strike and kill innocent Israelis, whose only crime is to live in the state of Israel, they have not only a right to strike first, they have an obligation to do so. And so this is a rocky policy. And I'm sure if I were talking to the Palestinians, what they would say is, if they were really honest with me, they would say, well, you know, if we ever, you know, if we give up on Hamas, then we don't have any leverage to move forward in the peace agreement. And so Israel responds by saying, well, we're going to build a fence. And the process of that building, of building that fence and all of the other stuff that goes with it, sets in motion a dynamic that tells the Palestinians that the clock is ticking for peace. So I think there's some very complicated issues here. If I were president, I'd put a very senior person in charge of this. I'd give it my personal attention as well. It's a first order priority of the United States. I look at what this administration has done, how this president ducked the problem for 2 years, how even today his roadmap has very little personal engagement, personal connection. And I think of the terrible loss of life, the waste of human life, the conflict, the hatred. One thing I've learned is in my work in the Balkans and visits elsewhere around the globe, that you very seldom solve political problems by killing people. You intensify them. The killing needs to stop.
What would the cornerstones be of a Clark policy on China?
Well, first of all, I think it's in our interest with China that we develop them and bring them into the world community and give them a stake in a stable world community, that they not become a huge, isolated, rogue nation. We always said you can either engage China or you can contain China. If you engage it and something goes wrong, you could always contain it. But if you contained it first, you'll never be able to engage it. And that's why each successive administration is trying to engage China. Nothing wrong with that. But we need also to recognize our own leadership responsibilities in Asia. I would not have gone to the Chinese and asked for their assistance to open negotiations with North Korea. I see no reason why the United States can't talk directly to North Korea and end this crisis and impasse over North Korean nuclear weapons. We should have done it a year ago. That's hurt our leverage with China. Nor would I have sent the Treasury Secretary on a political mission announcing that he was going to go over and demand the Chinese revalue their currency. That's a very unlikely to be successful tactic. That's like a lot of things that this administration has done. Not much policy, but lots of politics. So what we need to do is we need to engage China. We need to work with China. And China needs to understand that we're not going to tolerate a Chinese policy that artificially pegs the renminbi at a low level to exploit the American workforce. It's just not going to happen. We're going to use a variety of means at our disposal. And we're not going to necessarily advertise it. And we're not going to put it up on the wall at Kmart and say, we're sending the Treasury Secretary over there. We're just going to do it. It's part of the normal dialogue and discourse among nations. But China has a stake in the world economy, just like it has a stake in its own economy. And it must know that it must participate fully, cooperate fully, and take only its fair share and no more than its fair share to meet its own development needs. I got this lady right here. She needs a microphone, though.
Are you winning? Thank you very much for running.
Thank you.
Good evening, General Clark. My name is Matt Aquinas, Econo Bunga. I'm a Henneker resident. I go to Bunga College. And I was born in Zambia, and I know that you wanted to make America proud, great, you know, just a good nation for everyone to be proud of and admire throughout the world. How would you like to do this, to make America proud and prestigious and to be admired throughout the world?
Well, as I travel around the world, and obviously you know Zambia, and I've not been to Zambia, but as I travel around the world, what I've found is that generally Americans are liked. The problem is the policies of the government. It's not that they don't like us. In fact, you know, Mr. Bush has said that they hate us for our values, but the honest truth is we have something like 3 million Asian and Middle Eastern Muslims who live in America, and they're living here because of our values and our freedoms. That's why they like us. So I think we have to be more respectful of other nations. Obviously, we're going to protect our interests. We're not going to allow our workers to be exploited. We're not going to allow nations to threaten the United States, and we're not going to allow them to host terrorists. But we're also not going to bully and push and lecture. We're going to talk to those that share our values. We're going to try to be supportive. We're going to try to reinforce. We're going to try to encourage democratic development around the world. There are many ways to do this. So I think we have to be very careful. There are some people in the current administration who apparently believed that there was a window of opportunity in which the United States, without the Soviet Union, was free to use its military power and could clean up the mess, so to speak, by using its military power. I've heard that talked about. I can't cite a specific document on it, but I have heard it discussed. I think it's a total misreading of the world. I think what it is if you want to be respected, you have to treat other nations with respect. And when our allies, who are democracies like us, disagree with us, we shouldn't expect that we can arm twist and force them to go along with our will. I think the President of the United States has to, and his government, have to respect the democratic institutions in other nations. I think we have to recognize the President of the United States is more than an American political leader. He is a symbol, a symbolic leader for much of the world. And people look to him to set standards, to treat others with respect, to reach out beyond the borders of this country. And I think if we have those attitudes and we put in place the right kinds of programs, that we can be much more successful than we've been in the past. There will always be some, and memories are long, and it's not a popularity contest, and the President of the United States has important responsibilities to this country that must come first of all. But still, at the turn of the 20th century, America was the largest industrial power in the world. For much of the 20th century, we were the most admired and respected country in the world. That was the case because we respected others. We didn't covet their resources. We didn't covet their land. We didn't try to push their governments. We can restore that respect if we treat others with respect. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I hadn't been to New England College before. I'm tremendously impressed. You ask great questions. And if you're willing to give up your Friday evening to be here to talk tough, heavy-duty policy stuff with me, then I know you're going to vote, and I know you're great citizens in this democracy. And whether you're Republicans or Democrats or independents is a lot less important than if you're patriotic Americans and you care about our country. Thank you so much for being here with us today. Thank you.
What'd you think?
Oh, I thought it was great.
Compared to what?
Actually, I've been following Dennis Kucinich around, and I think I might I might switch. I do have some environmental questions for him, though. I think I'll give the local office a call or something.
Main reason for Clark would be what?
He's really smart. He's really, really smart. And I think in this day and age, after 9/11 and all this international stuff that's going on, I think he's the only guy that can help save this country from the rest of the world, but also protect the people, if that makes any sense. Can it make that? You know, I'm hoping that it can.
Cool.
Yep.